The date today is March 27th, 2004. This is Dave Adelson speaking with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. And I thought we'd start off just simply if you could talk a little bit about your own background with the CIA and also possibly what you've been doing since you left the CIA.
Sure. I'm Ray McGovern. I came down to Washington in 1963. I was one of those folks that responded to John Kennedy's challenge to see what we might be able to do for our country rather than what our country might be able to do for us. I was an officer in the Army at the time, having been commissioned out of ROTC. And after I finished my active service, since my major in graduate as well as undergraduate school was Russian studies, and since I had heard about this new agency, which was tasked with the challenge of analyzing what the Soviets were up to, I applied for and landed a job as an analyst of Soviet foreign policy with the CIA, and that was in 63, 64.
So during the course of your CIA career, what kind of responsibilities were you tasked with?
I initially was an analyst of Soviet foreign policy, specifically policy toward China and the international communist movement and Southeast Asia. Since this was Vietnam time, that was a very active account, and I had a very large responsibilities for the length of service that I had been there. Later, as the years went by, I became chief of that branch. Then my responsibilities widened. I ended up being one of the daily briefers who go down to the White House, State Department, Defense Department, Pentagon, and the vice president's office to share the president's daily brief one-on-one with the principals. I did that for 4 years during the years of Ronald Reagan and his senior leaders. And before that, I also participated in and actually chaired a number of national intelligence estimates, which have come very much into public discussion with respect to the abortion that was called a National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq, done in September and October of 2002.
How much of your role was to inform them about implications of potential U.S. action versus just providing information about what's happening at this moment? Mm-hmm. In other words, how much of it was projective as opposed to retrospective?
Well, the two really cannot be so neatly divided. What we would do is review the bidding each morning, what was going on in the world. We would have a knowledge from our discussions over the years, actually, with senior policymakers, what was on their front burners. And so we would naturally be aware of that as we planned our daily brief for the next morning. We would pick those topics which we knew to be on their front burner or those topics which we knew should be on their front burner but were not. And any president's daily brief would contain from 4 to sometimes as many as 9 or 10 one-page articles and then a few real short articles and maybe one major one. So by the time the principal finished reading the daily brief, we were pretty confident that he or she knew everything that was important with respect to what we could glean from the previous day or the previous week's reporting. Now, that would naturally inform their decisions as to what to do about these developments, and often they would have questions. And I'd say about half the time, since we briefers had participated in the preparation of this thing the day before, since we knew all the sources that were used, we could about half the time answer those questions on the spot. A pretty weighty responsibility, but we had that confidence. We were all senior people. Half the time we could not. And so what we would do is promise an answer as soon as that person needed it, go back to agency headquarters, call out the experts that knew the answer or were responsible for knowing the answer, and come back with the answer the next day or sooner if the answer were needed sooner.
I don't quite understand yet, and I don't think a lot of listeners will understand where the goals of policy entered into the process of evaluating information and disseminating it in this system.
Yeah.
Your own political beliefs, where were they in this process?
They were not there. I probably should just backtrack just a little bit to remind people that the CIA was set up in 1947 by the National Security Act for two main purposes. One was so that there would never be a Pearl Harbor, another one. And to prevent that, you needed one central place, therefore Central Intelligence Agency, one central place in possession of all the information, whether it comes from the Army, Navy, Air Force, overhead photography, intercepted communications, embassies, bars, wherever, agents, that information needed to come into the, in those days, inbox of one person who was responsible and accountable for looking at that and making sure that he or she gleaned what policymakers needed to know about that information and put it in readable form in a succinct way so that policymakers would read it the next morning. So that was one major objective of the CIA. The other one was that there'd be a place in government that could tell the truth without fear or favor. There'd be a place in government not subservient to the State Department having to defend policy, not subservient to the Defense Department having to make the Soviets out to be 10 feet tall, but one place where the President of the United States could go and say to his director, look, I want you to tell me what you and your experts really think, okay? What you really think. I don't care what the State Department says. I don't care what the Defense Department says. I want to know what you really think. This is what I'm thinking of doing. I want your reaction to this, and I want it tomorrow, and I want it pure and simple, and I want it without fear or favor. Now, you can imagine what an asset that is to orderly policymaking if the president has that kind of resource to tap in making sensible policy. And that, of course, is the tragedy of what's happened over the last 2 years. That process has been corrupted. Whether the president knows it or not, he no longer has the opportunity to go to the CIA and expect that straightforward an answer because it has been so thoroughly politicized. In any case, those are the two main reasons for the CIA. Most other people think about the more catchy TV movie type things where what we call covert action is glorified. That is sort of an ancillary function of the CIA. That also comes in that same National Security Act of 1947, but it comes in a sort of tacked on phrase that says, the CIA shall perform such other duties as the President and the National Security Council shall from time to time direct. Okay. Now, why was that? Well, that was because here it is, 47, the Soviets are overrunning Eastern Europe. We had this incredible asset during the war, the Office of Strategic Services. It did wonderful things in the European and Asian theaters. And were we just going to disband that? Or are we going to keep the capability to combat, to counter the KGB and other secret services? Well, obviously, we couldn't let it go by the board. And so that was tacked on as a way for the president to do these covert things. And the place they put it was the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, in a real sense, that's a structural fault because one director is responsible for doing that kind of covert action and analyzing, in some cases, the results of that or the prospects for success for that covert action. So it takes a very strong director to overcome that schizophrenia and still perform his major service, which is his duty by statute of being the principal intelligence advisor to the President of the United States.
Well, following on that idea of the schizophrenia, am I correct that the functions of analysis and the operational functions are separated bureaucratically?
Yes, they're very separate. They're almost hermetically sealed off from one another, with one exception, and that is that the very legitimate process of collecting intelligence, that involves sources and methods that the analyst needs to know about. In other words, he needs to know whether this is some bartender in Cairo or whether it's some high-level official in the Egyptian government. So the clandestine service, which runs the collection aspect of agent reporting, needs to give the analysts enough information about the source so that they can be confident with respect to what kind of credence to give the provenance of this or that piece of intelligence.
But doesn't that imply already a corruption of the data stream? Because if operations does have particular interests in the conduct of its business, and it is responsible for providing you with the raw data, doesn't that right there create some conflict? I mean, I imagine that that's taken into account when evaluating field reports, but...
Yeah, the potential is there, Dave. There's no doubt about that. Integrity counts. And during my 27 years there, we had people with integrity who knew that their first duty was to pursue the truth. And so the people on the operational side were almost always willing to give the analysts enough guidance with respect to how much credence to put in this or that source that the correct appreciation was garnered. I'll say that in a very good way, because, as I say, you're right. The potential is there for that kind of abuse, but if you have a bunch of reasonable, intelligent, and integrity-filled people, you can overcome that kind of encumbrance.
I'm curious, when you talk about politics not entering into analysis, it strikes me that in order to do a proper analysis of the actions of somebody and their motivations, it requires almost an in-their-shoes understanding of their own political motivations. And that takes really a kind of cultural immersion. And it seems to me that it does require your politics to enter into it, because what you believe about what motivates people, what's possible in the world, and what are the moving forces in the world affects what you're able to see.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of the proposition that politics are actually inseparable from analysis? Or maybe you could talk a little bit about why it is that they are separable, if you think that that's the case.
Yeah. Well, they're only separable in analysis in one sense. And that is, when people say politics, at least these days, I assume they mean, are you Republican or Democrat, or do you have a political agenda of some kind? Now, in that sense, they have to be separable, because if you're going to do pure, unadulterated analysis, you have to divorce yourself from whatever regime is in power in Washington and just look at the facts and let them lead you where you need to go. Now, do you need to be politically astute to be able to discover, to analyze, and to report on what's going on in London or what's going on in Baghdad? Obviously, you have to be immersed in those politics. You should ideally be someone who had lived in Baghdad for 10 years and acquired a little bit of the concept that out of which these people think. So politics is essential for that kind of analysis of foreign governments. Where it gets in the way is if you know, for example, that the president wants you to come up with a memorandum that says Iraq has weapons of mass destruction that threaten the United States, that's politics. If you trim your analysis to show that, and the facts don't warrant that conclusion, well, that's the unpardonable sin. That's the sin that will not be forgiven by intelligence professionals, and that's the kind of sin that's been committed repeatedly over the last 2 years.
And that the commission of that sin, in your estimation, is a radical departure from what has gone on at the CIA, at least on the analysis side, since its inception. This is a new animal.
I would love to be able to say that. I would love to be able to say yes. But actually, it started under William Casey and his protege, Bobby Gates. When Casey came in with Reagan, he had this mindset. The Soviets were behind everything untoward that happened in the world. The Soviets, interestingly enough, were behind all terrorist acts, according to Bill Casey. So, for example, when the assassination attempt was made on the Pope, who was behind that? Well, Casey knew right off the bat. It had to be the Soviets. He asked my friends who were working on that area to do a memorandum. They pored over the evidence. There was not the shred of evidence indicating Soviet involvement or Bulgarian involvement. It looked like this crazy Acha fella had done it pretty much on his own. So they came up and they told it like it was. Casey tore up that memo, created a little group of four analysts, put them over on another side of the building, gave them the source material, and said, "I'm confident that you can do better." And guess what? They came up with the, quote, correct, end quote, answer. The Soviets and Bulgarians were behind it. And guess what? That was the piece of paper that was sent down to the White House. So what I'm saying here is two things. It started with Bill Casey, big time, institutional corruption, institutional cooking of intelligence analysis to the recipe of high policy. And the techniques used, well, you can see them persisting to this day. They're tried and trusted. Look what happened when the Pentagon couldn't get the, quote, correct, end quote, answer to the existence of ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. What did they do? Well, when the agency analysts could see no link at all, they set up their special little off-the-line group, their mini CIA in the bowels of the Pentagon, the Office of Special Plans, and guess what, folks? They came up with the correct answer. There were great ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda going many years back. Of course, there's not a shred of truth to that, but they came up with the right answer, and that was stovepiped right up to Secretary Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and of course, the President of the United States. So the corruption started back in the early 80s, and I'm very, very sorry to tell you this, but the kinds of people, you know, take those three, four, five people who were set up in the other part of the building to come up with the right answer. Well, those are the senior managers, the CIA now. And so when George Tenet, the director of CIA, comes back from the White House with his instructions, i.e., do a national intelligence estimate that comes up with the same conclusions that Dick Cheney just said in his speech on August 26, 2002. George Tenet doesn't have, well, if someone came back in my day and said, "Well, this is what the White House wants us to do," we would say, give me a break, man. You must be kidding. We're not going to do that kind of thing. That's not our job. But now you've got a bunch of senior managers who are so malleable, who are so used to sniffing which way the wind is blowing and trimming their sails accordingly, that Tenet has no trouble at all. You want that kind of conclusion and estimate? We'll do it. We'll do it in 3 weeks, and we'll do it. We'll just ram it right through, and it will be just what Dick Cheney and the others want. And that, my friends, is what's happened here. That's why there's no real noun to describe the kind of outrage that we veteran intelligence professionals feel as we watch the corruption of something that, believe it or not, is very sacred. This process, if it's going to get anywhere near the truth, has to be pure. And watching it prostituted, and that's not too strong a word, watching it prostituted is a little bit like, it's a little bit like watching somebody you really love being violated.
You mentioned that this intelligence, this cooked intelligence, essentially gets stovepiped to the major policymakers. If the process is initiated by them, and this is what they want to be hearing, then presumably the creation of that intelligence is not really for them. It's for somebody else.
Good.
Now, who is it for? At the moment, of course, the whole hullabaloo about WMD and the corporate press is about whether or not the intelligence was flawed and why was the intelligence flawed. And so you could say, well, this is to provide a cover for those policymakers. But in the normal course of business, it never rises to this level. So who is this for? Is this for the people in Congress who allocate the money?
Wow.
But for whom is it?
Well, you're right. Take 2002, for example. We know, everyone knows who's taken a look at things, that the final decision to make war in Iraq was made at the very latest in the spring of 2002. Some people date it back to 9/12/2001, and there's lots of evidence that that's true too. But at the very latest, the plans were said and approved by the president in the spring of 2002.
Excuse me, how is that known?
Well, it's known from several ways. There are anecdotal things like Condoleezza Rice telling the head of state policy planning, look, this was in June of 2002, look, don't remonstrate with the other policymakers. The decision has already been made. Don't waste your breath. I have an email from the father of a 82nd Airborne trooper who was told in May and June of 2002 that he was going to Iraq, that they were training to go to Iraq. And the father tells me, you know, I kept saying, no, it has to be Afghanistan. It has to be Afghanistan. No, no, Dad, they keep telling me Iraq. And there are a whole slew of other things when the military plans were put into effect and everything. So there isn't much doubt but that the decision was made that early. Why do I stress that? Well, the question is, what was the intelligence community saying in the spring of 2002? And guess what? They weren't saying anything. There was no national intelligence estimate. You have to understand that before a major decision is taken in the foreign policy area by our government, particularly a decision on war and peace, always, a national intelligence estimate is ordered by the president or someone else, so the intelligence community can pronounce in a coordinated way on what the issues are. And there was no such estimate. Why was there no such estimate? Well, it's very clear to me that if George Tenet, the head of the CIA, had ordered up an estimate like that, it wouldn't have been supportive of the decision to make war in Iraq. Why? Because Iraq was not a danger to the United States, or even to its neighbors. Why do I say that? Well, I say that because Colin Powell, on the 24th of February 2001, said that. He said, Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction and is not even a conventional threat to its neighbors. 24th of February 2001, I have the videotape. Condoleezza Rice said pretty much the same thing in July of 2001. And so, during the months before 9/11, Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. All of a sudden, how many times have you heard 9/11 changed everything? Well, all of a sudden, by some alchemy or magic, Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Was there good intelligence to support that? Of course not. So how could they do an estimate that would justify plans for war? They couldn't, and so they didn't. And George Tenet, the head of the CIA, kept his head way down, until when? Well, until they realized, they came back from vacation, summer vacation in 2002, and said, okay, we're going to do this war. What's the first thing we have to do? Somebody said, well, oh, bummer. There's this Constitution thing. It says that only Congress can declare war, so I guess we're going to have to persuade Congress. Well, at that point, Congress woke up from its sleep and realized that there was no national intelligence estimate. So Bob Graham, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, ordered one up. So that estimate, that one that was so wrong, demonstrably wrong, in virtually every major point it made, which dovetailed... This estimate, which dovetailed with what Dick Cheney said on the 26th of August in 2002, namely that Saddam Hussein was reconstituting his nuclear weapons program and that UN inspectors were not worth anything, okay? That estimate was prepared in 3 weeks, and it was briefed during its preparation to whom? To the Congress. So the answer to your question is that particular piece of intelligence was fashioned so that Congress would be persuaded that there was this great threat from weapons of mass destruction. Now we know there were not any weapons of mass destruction at that time, and the analysis was at best inept, at worst prostituted. The estimate was wrong. The decision to go to war was made irrespective of that estimate and many months before it. And the estimate's purpose was to deceive Congress, was to participate in the administration's attempt to deceive the branch of government that has the constitutional right to send our young men and women off to war, to deceive them into forfeiting that constitutional right and allowing the president to make a war in Iraq. That, my friends, is worse than, I mean, that the prostitution of intelligence pales in significance next to the prostitution of the constitutional process, the subversion of the constitutional process. I am not aware in my lifetime, 40 years watching things very closely here in Washington, I am not aware of any time when one branch of government deliberately set out in a well-orchestrated many-month campaign to deceive another branch of government into forfeiting, into ceding its own constitutional duty on a matter of such importance, as I watched in the fall of 2002. And it was to my great regret that the agency for whom I used to work participated in that effort. Why? Well, for the reasons I adduced earlier. George Tenet was doing the president's bidding, and he had a malleable core of senior managers who should have protested, should have quit, but went along with it. Why is George Tenet so malleable? Well, his experience is antithetical to the experience that a director of Central Intelligence needs. George comes out of a congressional milieu where everything is compromise, everything, you shave this, you shave that. When he was appointed, the great point was made out of the fact that he was equally popular on both sides of the aisle. Well, ordinarily, that's a great advantage. But we intelligence officers knew that to be the kiss of death. Because if you're going to tell the truth, you're going to make enemies right and left. And you can't be a compromiser, and you can't be too willing to please. Newt Gingrich, who is now back in play here as one of the Pentagon advisors and making these decisions on war and peace, if you can believe it, and a frequent visitor to CIA headquarters also, if you can believe it. He came back and told a talk show host about 4 months ago, and I quote, George Tenet is so grateful to the president that he'll do anything for him. Now, why grateful? I assume the context was grateful that he didn't get fired after 9/11. But what I would simply say is that that's precisely the wrong kind of dynamic to have between the Director of Central Intelligence and the President. Director of Central Intelligence has to be able to tell the President, look, you're the emperor, but you have no clothes on. This is how we really see the situation. You're being very ill-advised to think, for example, that Iraq has many weapons of mass destruction that are a threat to local people in the region or to people in the United States.
Well, if these cooked intelligence estimates are intended to persuade or deceive Congress, and in this case, if the level of the deception was so apparent and outrageous, it begs the question whether or not Congress actually wanted to be deceived. Because my impression is that from the information that was out there, anybody with an interest in knowing would have known and could have known. I assume that tape of Colin Powell you referred to did not require a security clearance to get access to. I assume that was part of the public record. I also assume that while there is a chain of information flow that's formal, there's also an informal, a number of informal channels of information flow, so that it would have been quite possible for anybody interested in the Congress to have determined immediately that this was a deception. So the fact that they were willing to be deceived and then later shocked to find gambling going on in this establishment really begs the question of, how to put it? I'll paraphrase a quote an acquaintance once shared with me, which was that in order to be effective, propaganda has to serve the ulterior motives of the person hearing it. So in this case, what does it mean that Congress was willing to be deceived by such demonstrably false statements?
Well, it's a mite too far to say that they were demonstrably false at that point in time. We veteran intelligence professionals for sanity thought they were largely false. But even we could not bring ourselves to say what some of us felt, that is, quote, there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, if this were a foreign country, and we reviewed the information on that foreign country, mostly the mass media, which the media analysis gives you 90% of the answer on many of these things. If that were a foreign country, we would have said those leaders are lying through their teeth. We can see their statements. They're disingenuous. They're deceptive. If they had the information, they would have given it to the UN. These guys don't want the UN to resolve this thing. They want to make a war. That's what we would have said. We had a postmortem a couple of months after all this. And we asked ourselves, now, why were we unable to say that? And the answer was a little embarrassing. It was because there was a major flaw in our analysis. We are, we think, pretty critical, pretty hardcore intelligence analysts, not easily dissuaded, but we were dissuaded. We were dissuaded by the fact that we are Americans, and we could not separate ourselves adequately from the statements of the President of the United States. The President of the United States was saying, there is no doubt. Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, everyone saying, there is no doubt. We have proof positive. And so there was something that just didn't parse. And we just couldn't bring ourselves to believe that the President of the United States would be lying through his teeth to that extent. And so we said, very carefully hedged, we said, there are certainly not enough weapons of mass destruction to warrant an invasion of Iraq, but we think there are probably some left over from earlier on or whatever. We always hedged that. In reality, we should have just done it as though he were a foreign leader and spoken out that way. So that's an important learning that we learned. And the terrible conclusion of that, of course, is that we can no longer give the President of the United States the benefit of the doubt. We have to treat the President of the United States just like any other foreign leader and say, what does the evidence suggest? There were subordinate officials in government saying, well, don't get your hopes up about finding large stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction because there might not be any. Paul Wolfowitz was asked, well, what's the evidence you have on weapons of mass destruction? He said, well, it's a little bit like pornography. I'll recognize it when I see it. Oh, my God, here's the guy leading the charge. So there were lots of snippets out there. But in answer to your question, it really comes down to politics. Everyone forgets. Midterm elections. The next month. November 2002. With all the hype, who is going to take the risk of seeming to go against the President of the United States when the country is in mortal danger? Okay? And so this was one of Karl Rove's major coups. He orchestrated this thing, timed it in such a way that it happened in October, and that the votes were very hard for Democrats to vote against this war. I don't defend there. I just have utter contempt for the way some of the Democrats caved in. They should have known better. But political realities are what govern their decisions, and they couldn't let themselves be seen as being soft on, quote, terrorism, end quote, even though Iraq had nothing to do with, quote, terrorism, end quote.
Isn't it interesting that in the lead-up to an election, elected officials would be more scared of going against the president than they would be of violating their constitutionally mandated responsibility to declare war and instead sign it over to the president?
It's a very sad commentary.
In the movie Uncovered, in Robert Greenwald's documentary Uncovered, there are several points in it where people express real dismay, almost shock, at the introduction now of the concept of preemptive war. Milt Bearden, among them, speaks about that. And I think of the invasions of places like Panama and particularly Grenada. And I find myself wondering, was the invasion of Grenada something... Well, what was the invasion of Grenada? Let me ask it this way. When we invaded Grenada, what was the nature of the intelligence that was justifying okay. the invasion of Grenada?
Another good question. Grenada came just a little while after the bombing of the Marine barracks in Lebanon. Grenada is a direct result of that. Caspar Weinberger, George Shultz, President Reagan were incredibly embarrassed by leaving so many of our Marines so vulnerable. I think there were over 200 killed that Sunday morning. And they needed to show that the U.S. was no patsy. To their great delight, a ragtag crew took over in Grenada. One or two of them had Cuban connections, and they made the mistake of taking hostage, or at least sequestering some American medical students there at the medical school there in Grenada. The administration knew this to be an opportunity. Grenada was certainly not going to be a threat to our security, but on the pretext of rescuing these, quote, hostages, end quote, the Marines or the 82nd Airborne was sent in. The rationale was to rescue these and rescue Grenada from a Cuban takeover. All that was synthetic. All that was contrived. That had nothing to do with intelligence. As a matter of fact, intelligence 5 hours before the invasion of Grenada revealed to our top policymakers that these new leaders, the people who had taken over in Grenada, had already blinked and said they had given guarantees that nothing untoward would happen to the, quote, medical school hostages, end quote. But that was disregarded. This was, Grenada was pure and simple, an attempt by this administration to regain the initiative and show that we were really strong and powerful. We could work, we could send our troops into an area really quickly and prevail. Of course, we killed a bunch of Cubans. Some of our guys got killed too, but it was judged to be worth the effort because we needed to recoup our self-esteem in the wake of the terrible debacle in Lebanon. Intelligence didn't have anything to do with it. To the degree there was intelligence, the intelligence said these guys were no threat at all. They had already blinked.
Okay. Well, now I want to come back to the buildup to the Iraq war, and particularly the issue of intelligence. And although you said that it was not clear that these representations were utter lies, so that some congresspeople could reasonably believe that there might be some truth in it. Scott Ritter, who was a former UNSCOM inspector, was on the scene at the time of these representations about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, and he was arguing that the claims were untenable, if I'm not mistaken. What is the perception of Ritter's credibility within the analysis branch of the CIA?
Well, you know, I'm afraid we'll have to distinguish between the analysis, the analysts who were persuaded to go along with the prescribed thinking, and those analysts who were trying to do their darndest to tell it like it is. The latter category, of course, always agreed with Ritter. The evidence or the analysis techniques used were ludicrous. Take what I call the Rumsfeld theorem. I don't know, maybe he learned this at Princeton, but it goes like this. The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Okay? Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that just because we don't have any evidence that there are weapons of mass destruction, so-called, that doesn't mean that they're not there. Now, you take that to ridiculous extremes, and you can justify just about anything. The other major flaw, which I would call the corollary to the Rumsfeld theorem, is that if you have an aggregate number, however dubious to start out with, let's say Iraq has 25,000 tons of sarin, okay? Sarin nerve gas. 25,000 tons. We know that the UN inspectors destroyed 20,000 tons, okay? We know that 3,000 tons were destroyed by the US bombing. Therefore what? Therefore, 2,000 tons are what? What are they? Are they there? No, they're not there. They're unaccounted for, okay? And since the aggregate number was dubious to begin with, it's impossible to say that those 2,000 tons are there. And that, my friends, unfortunately, is what the intelligence community said. They have to be there because of our analysis by subtraction, and I've never seen a more ludicrous performance in my 27 years of intelligence analysis. So the analytical rules that were sort of dredged up or contrived to do this were really beyond the pale and ludicrous on their face.
I'm curious what you think of the use of the term weapons of mass destruction itself, as somebody who's job it was to accurately represent reality and threaten the world. What is your opinion of a catch-all term that lumps nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons?
Well, it's a part and function of an incredibly adept PR effort on the part of this administration. Its PR is unparalleled in the history of the American government. To lump chemical, biological weapons with nuclear weapons, which is the studied attempt done by use of the term weapons of mass destruction, is disingenuous but incredibly effective. Chemical weapons can be useful on a battlefield, but there are very limited usages for it. Biological weapons, very, very dangerous to use, not very much used and not very much understood. But nuclear weapons, well, we all know what nuclear weapons do. Those of us of my generation used to hide under desks in school to prevent ourselves from becoming fallout victims, if you can believe it. So that's really scary. That's the scare tactics there. So all this was very deliberate, to lump nuclear weapons together with these other weapons of less destruction and conjure up this notion that Iraq posed that kind of threat. Why did they do it? Well, Iraq had used chemical weapons. We knew that they had been working on biological weapons, so a case could be made that Iraq might have that capability. Nuclear weapons, nobody believed they had any nuclear weapons. Our own estimates, our official U.S. government estimates, said that they couldn't have a nuclear weapon before the end of the decade. Okay, so let's lump them all together and let's scare the American people. Well, all I'll say is that for people to uncritically accept this this slogan, and I mean the Fourth Estate, I mean the press, and this is the sea change I've observed in our body politic. We no longer have a free press. We no longer have a Bernstein and Woodward who would look at this term and say, "What does that really mean? What does that really mean? Is this propaganda or is this real discourse?" The press missed it, and so did Congress. I mean, Bob Graham, who was the Democrat heading up the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Porter Goss, the Republican heading up the House Intelligence Committee, well, they've given a new meaning to the word oversight. You know, they chair these oversight committees, but they're blindfolded. They don't want to know about these things. And it was their duty. It was their duty to look into these things on the behalf of the people who elected them and to get some clarity out of this and not fall prey to this propaganda. And as we indicated before, they did not do that. They fell down on the job. And not until decisions were made did they insist on an estimate. And even then, they acquiesced in the very title of the estimate. The estimate was called Iraq's Continuing Programs in Weapons of Mass Destruction. Now, the propaganda objective of that national intelligence estimate comes through in the title, Continuing Weapons of Mass Destruction Programs. When we did estimates in the past, we wouldn't put the conclusions of the estimate in the title, for God's sake. We'd say prospects for Iraq or prospects for Spain. It was never the conclusion there, Iraq's continuing weapons of mass destruction program. So the weapons of mass destruction label is propagandistic enough. To stick in the title continuing was to prejudge the prejudged or prearranged conclusions. And when I saw that, it was kind of, it told me, it spoke volumes to me. And I noticed, for example, that later on when they issued a sanitized version, they took out the continuing. Isn't that interesting? They took out the continuing from the title. So now the title is Iraq's Weapons of Mass Destruction Programs.
Well, if we fast forward today and we've still got the same Fourth Estate that we had at the time these representations were being made originally, and now there's all this talk of what the intelligence failures were in Iraq, and also now with the 911 hearings, what the intelligence failures were there, and it seems to be the general focus in the corporate media. What do you think of the propaganda environment right now? What is the worst of the propaganda that's coming through right now? What do people need to cut through and see at the moment? And as we speak now, it's late March of 2004.
Well, the spin is still on. Anyone who comes out and tells the truth, like Paul O'Neill, like Dick Clark, they are not argued against. They are not confronted by other lines of argument. They are denigrated. They are character assassinated. And so what people really need to be aware of now is, where do we look for the comeback on these charges? Dick Clark says the president didn't know what he was doing before 9/11, and Condoleezza Rice, his chief advisor, didn't know what she was doing either. They didn't even have a principals meeting until the week before 9/11, despite Dick Clark's urgent protestations that such a meeting needed to take place. And so what I'd ask the American people to be alert for is why? Why was there no meeting at the highest level on terrorism? Why, with all these warnings in the spring and summer of 2000 and 2001, why was there no meeting called? Why did the president go off to chop wood in Texas for a month? Why was it that Attorney General Ashcroft started flying only in government planes, whereas before he had flown commercial? Why was it that Dick Clark himself told his people not to fly at all if they could possibly avoid it? There was lots of information out there. And what I've been saying for many months now is that there are a host of unanswered questions, And most of the reason that they are unanswered is because the administration refuses to provide the answers, refuses to provide the materials upon which the answers could be gleaned, okay? So that's one thing. But it's not necessary to go into the question about how much the government knew before 9/11, whether perhaps they even knew it and allowed it, that kind of conspiracy theory. I would be very gentle in attacking people who are looking at the unanswered questions. I've learned the hard way. I believe the Warren Commission conclusions on JFK's assassination. I believe the commission that investigated Martin Luther King's assassination. No longer do I believe those two. And so I'm very, very careful not to dismiss people who are looking at these unanswered questions and come up with theories that might sound outlandish in the beginning. But what I do say is this: we know enough about what happened on 9/11 and the weeks thereafter and months thereafter to realize that the president and his senior associates decided in a very determined way to use the incredible trauma suffered by the American people, to use and to exploit that trauma to do what they had wanted to do from the outset of the administration, and that was to make war on Iraq, to invade Iraq, to take control of that country, to ensure the supply of foreign oil, and to establish military bases from which they could dominate that area to the advantage not only of the United States, but also the state of Israel.
But how radical a departure is that from business as usual in the United States? We do maintain military bases in over 125 of the 192 or so countries of the world. Why should anybody be concerned about this? Is it really a radical departure from what's been going on in the past?
This is a terribly radical departure of what's gone on in the past. Let's look at what happened. They needed a theoretical justification for starting an unprovoked war. They decided to dredge up a new theory. The president began it when he made a speech at West Point. Then Condoleezza Rice put together the strategic document out of the National Security Council in September of 2002. And it talked about preemption. It talked about the U.S. Being hell-bent on preempting any terrorist or other nation from striking at the United States. Okay? Now, we know now that there was nothing to preempt, okay? There was nothing to preempt. It was known at the time that the danger to the United States was nothing that we needed to preempt, okay? So let's stop talking about preemptive war. Preemptive war can be justified under certain conditions, under the universal right for self-defense. It's the same thing. If you see somebody just about to attack you, you can attack them first to preempt them from attacking you. That's not what we're dealing with here. What we're dealing with here is something called preventive war. Now, preventive war is the kind of war that Hitler excelled at, okay? The kind of war that is universally, widely condemned internationally by every international body as being illegal under international law. Preemptive war is, well, you say, well, that fellow might attack me some years down the road, so I'm going to take him out now. Well, that's the kind of threat, if there was any threat worth speaking about, that the United States faced with respect to Iraq. And so let's not be deceived into thinking this was a preemptive war. It was a preventive war, and the concept of preventive war has been universally criticized. If you look at the British, they faced a real problem when they decided to hitch their wagon to Bush right before the war started. Their attorney general had already ruled out such a war without UN sanction. And the U.S. leaned all over Blair and said, hey, get another opinion, for God's sake. We need another opinion. And so we got another opinion. And now that's coming into full bloom in London. And people are asking, please release both opinions, because how can you say on one day that this war could not be launched without another UN security resolution, and on the next day say, oh, I guess we don't need, I guess the old resolutions will suffice. How can you do that?
You've raised the issue of Nazi Germany on a couple of occasions. And what is the level of concern in the Washington bureaucracy, in the bureaucratic institutions of the government, that we are on a path of absolutely unaccountable fascistic power grabbing?
You know, it depends really on whom you're talking about. If you're talking about career civil servants who have been around for a while, the anxiety is grave. If you're talking about the folks who have been brought in with this administration, who are pretty much attuned to how it operates and its real objectives, then these people are not only nonchalant about it, but take it as part of the woodwork.
What is your own reception among your former colleagues as a result of your speaking out about these issues?
The former colleagues from whom I've heard have been uniformly approving in what they've said. They've said, please do speak out. You're speaking for all of us. My only regret is that not too many of them have said, how can I help? How can I speak out? I know about this too. There's a reluctance. There's a real deterrence, I guess, that works its way into people's psyche. And I feel that these times call for an all-out effort to spread truth around. But some folks have trouble buying into the notion that that they need to speak from their own experiences, even when they know that the system has been corrupted.
I heard you mention in your discussions after the movie Uncovered earlier in the week your own faith. What do you think of the use by the president and his inner circle of their fundamentalist Christian faith in the wars that they've been promoting and in the aggression that they've been engaged in?
Well, I guess outrageous is, again, applicable here. I guess I also have a good bit of outrage with respect to the mainstream religions. Many of my friends put it this way, that the institutional churches and synagogues are riding shotgun for the system. They should know that out of all our faith traditions, justice, truth, and peace are supreme values. That you can't have justice without truth. And you can't have justice without politics. Now, in a church setting, people say, you're getting into politics now. Right. Well, justice without politics is like a skeleton without flesh. Because politics is the form that justice or injustice takes. And if you're not aware of that, or you refuse to believe it, then Hitler can very easily build a Third Reich on your piety and your prayers. And that, of course, is exactly what Hitler proceeded to do. And be aware, my friends, that Hitler insisted that every parish in Germany have a working pastor in it, because he saw that kind of stability as very helpful to the objectives that he was pursuing. So what am I saying here? I'm saying that just as in Germany of the 30s, where there was all too few people who would speak out as they saw the coming injustices and persecutions, what we need to do is get back to the pursuit of truth and justice and peace, and get away from this this contrived religiosity. You know, the notion that God blesses America, really the imperative mood, God bless America, that the Bush administration started off when this war started, that's a time-honored technique. I mean, Hitler's armies marched off to war with their belt buckles saying, Gott mit uns, God is with us. And you go back to the Crusades, and on their shields with crosses, they would say, Deus volt, God wills that we do these kinds of things. So it's really quite outrageous that this kind of thing should be sold in this day and age as something that God favors America, God will bless America, and we are pursuing this in some degree, with God's will and with God's blessing.
You mentioned a moment ago that Hitler wanted a working pastor in every church, and I didn't understand the reference or the meaning of that.
Well, he actually passed an ordinance requiring that the various dioceses and the various congregations ensure that each little church in Germany, no matter how small, had a working pastor, and they were already running short of clergy in those days. Hitler was confident that he could depend on such people, priests, Lutheran or Catholic, in being a force for stability and not challenging his regime. And you know, the worst part of all this, of course, is that he calculated correctly, and I see a direct parallel here.
Where do you think this is all going? I mean, right now, there is a rising perception, even in corporate media, that there's been massive lying. Do you think people in the country really care? And what do you think the effect of testimony like Richard Clark's and others is going to be, particularly to people now in the Congress, who went along with it in the first instance. Is this going to cause a major change, in your opinion?
Well, I think the most important thing is that a couple of our young men and women are being killed every week, more than a couple, in Iraq. The president is prone to make jokes of this by looking under his carpet and under his desk for weapons of mass destruction. I think the American people will gradually feel an appropriate sense of outrage at all that. They will see, if not their own sons and daughters, the sons and daughters of others coming home in caskets or coming home without arms or without legs. I recently very badly hurt my left wrist, and I got to thinking what it would feel not to have a left wrist or not to have a left arm. It gave me some little appreciation for what many of the amputees are suffering. And so as it becomes a little bit more clear that 8, 9, 10,000 U.S. military have been severely hurt, in addition to the 600 or so that have been killed, as it becomes clear that literally uncountable Iraqi citizens have been killed, thousands of them, why is it literally uncountable? Well, it's literally uncountable because our satrap, our proconsul there, Paul Bremer, has forbidden the Iraqi authorities to count civilian casualties. As all this becomes a little clearer, I have a basic faith in the American people that they will see this for what it is. My only concern is that they have to be aware. And if it's true that most of them watch Fox TV, I really despair of their becoming aware. Eight months ago, I was on Fox TV, my one and only time. I was supposed to be talking about weapons of mass destruction. The interviewer said, well, Mr. McGovern, you're supposed to be talking about WMD, but we've just completed a poll, and it says that 69% of the American people don't care if WMD are found in Iraq or not. What do you say to that? And I said, well, that's not surprising at all, because the American people haven't been told what's going on, because Fox and other news outlets don't explain these things to them.
Did they air that?
Yeah, well, it was live, so it was my only chance. And the fellow said, oh, so you're blaming Fox? And no, not just Fox. I'm saying Fox and all the other mainstream TV outlets. They don't tell the American people what's going on. And so why should you be surprised that 69% of the American people don't care about something that was adduced as the main reason for our first unprovoked invasion of a foreign country?
You know, there are a lot of people saying that what Bush and this administration have done has actually dramatically increased the odds of terrorist attacks on Americans here and around the world, and that we have ushered in an age of hostility towards America based on imperial aggression from which there will be no pulling out. What is the way out of this cycle of violence?
Well, I think one has to be sensible. One has to look at more than just the symptoms. People talk about how to fight terrorism. Well, you fight terrorism, you counter terrorism or eradicate it the same way you eradicate malaria. Obviously, with malaria, what you do is you station a platoon of riflemen around the swamp and you try to shoot as many mosquitoes as you can find exiting the swamp. I mean, that's very effective, right? Well, give me a break. That's what we're doing on terrorism. The swamp is there. What's the swamp? Well, you just look at Al Jazeera TV for two nights in a row and you will see U.S.-made attack helicopters target assassinating people in Palestine. You will see U.S.-made Caterpillar bulldozers bulldozing Palestinian homes. You will see all kinds of atrocities committed in the West Bank and Gaza, supposedly in retaliation for suicide bombings in the other direction. I don't condone suicide bombings, but I ask people to think about three generations of Palestinians living in that squalor. I mean, it comes down to this. In 1968, in this country, when Martin Luther King was assassinated and all hell broke loose in Washington, D.C. There were a lot of terrible things happening on 14th Street. Marion Wright Edelman tells a story of walking down that street, seeing a 14-year-old boy with a big boulder ready to throw it through a store window, and she grabs his arm and she says, "Son, don't do that." And he looks up and he says, "Ma'am, why not?" And she said, "Well, think about your future." And he looked up at her and he said, "Ma'am, I ain't got no future." And that's the feeling that you're getting here among the Arabs and the people who see that there's not much future in their area as long as what happens in Israel-Palestine continues to happen, and as long as they see no reasonable redress of their grievances. And, you know, the final analysis, why is Osama bin Laden so popular? Well, one of the things he used to always say is that the United States is interested in invading an Arab country and seizing all the assets that they have and waging this war of the West against Islam. Guess what's happened? The U.S. has done that. So in answer to your question, there's no question. Dick Clark is absolutely right. The world, Spain, Morocco, wherever you look, and the United States is in much more danger from terrorism now than it was before the unprovoked attack on Iraq.
What does this mean to the people within the CIA right now, the analysts who are trying to represent the truth, who are seeing the real implications of all this? What does it mean to them? What are they doing right now? What do you think is happening inside the bowels of that agency?
Well, they're... I guess I would have to confess that one of the most profound disappointments we veteran intelligence professionals have is that no one from the CIA has chosen to speak out. There are literally hundreds of people who know what lies were told. This is why, of course, Karl Rove and the White House clique that decided to release Valerie Plame's name and to out her as a covert CIA employee.
That's the wife of former Ambassador Joe Wilson, who publicly stated that the claims about Niger selling yellowcake uranium to Iraq were hollow claims.
That's correct, yeah. That was their reason for doing that, was to tell anybody else who, like her husband, might be inclined to tell about the lies, to tell them, look, you're going to pay a price. Your record may be clean, but you've got a wife, you've got kids. Maybe one of your kids was on drugs. You got a job. Don't think that you can come out and tell what really happened here. And I'm sorry to say that so far that tactic, however embarrassing it's been to the administration, it's worked. No one from the CIA has come out and spoken out. Have others? To their great credit, three Foreign Service officers quit very early on because they were unwilling to tell the lies. One very senior Australia intelligence official quit, Andrew Wilkie. That was 10 days before the war. And, of course, Catherine Gunn, who works in the British equivalent of NSA, the National Security Agency. She released the information that the U.S. and the U.K. were trying to manipulate the votes at the U.N. by monitoring and spying on the telephones and email accounts of the critical members on the Security Council. So she released that in hopes of forestalling the war. This calls for, you know, rising above petty bureaucratic considerations. And in the agency, I know it so well. I mean, you've got a mortgage, you've got kids in college. Most important, you love the work. The work is incredibly exciting work. It's important work. And so the tendency is to keep your head down, live through this administration so that you can fight the battle again. But the reality is that unless people come out, as they have to me just in these last few days, and say, "I know Dick Clark. Dick Clark is a straight shooter. Dick Clark was dedicated to his job. He's a man full of integrity. And I know he's right because A, B, and C I can tell you about." Unless that happens, I will continue to be profoundly disappointed in my former colleagues.
If you could comment briefly on some of the things that have come up in the testimony of Richard Clark, the 9-1-1 hearings, and what you think will be coming out in the near term that has not yet come out. What are the key things that people who are just learning about this really need to understand?
Well, the most important thing has to do with Iraq. Now, both Paul O'Neill and now Dick Clark have made it very clear that Iraq was about something quite different from all the reasons adduced by the administration in going to war there. We are in a quagmire now in Iraq, losing several young men and women every week. There is no sensible way out of that quagmire. Why? Because the people responsible for getting us in there don't have a clue. They didn't have a clue as to what to expect after going in, and they don't have a clue now. What needs to happen is the American people have to realize that if the main reasons, as I believe they were to secure access to Iraqi oil and to be able to dominate that region of the world so the foreign supply of oil will be guaranteed for our country, and if military bases are needed, in our view, to ensure that and to be able to enable us to dominate that part of the world, then this war is going to go on forever. It's going to be another Vietnam. If, on the other hand, this regime in Washington can admit that this was one very large mistake, that we need to hand this over to the UN, we will leave our troops in there for as long as necessary until people can fill in behind us to secure the area and to make sure that sectional strife doesn't win the day, then that's a whole different ball of wax. Then that would require a lot of eating of crow, but at least we would be on the path to extricating ourselves with some dignity from this worst foreign policy mistake since Vietnam. Actually, I think it's in some ways developing as, well, it is. It's worse than Vietnam because it was done not out of a miscalculation or naivete, but done for reasons other than the ones presented to the American people.
You were talking about the daily briefing, and you were talking about the information that on August 6, 2001, the president received in the daily briefing, information of an impending al-Qaeda attack. How unusual was that information? Is there always information about some impending threat, or is there any reason that you believe that claim was distinctive and should have been dealt with in ways other than it was dealt with?
Well, the setting was this. Throughout the spring and the summer of 2001, there was what people have been referring to as a spike in all the indicators that something really atrocious was being planned by al-Qaeda. There were numerous intelligence briefings. There were numerous calls. Dick Clark was not able to get the real people who could be the movers and shakers interested. He couldn't get them together until the 4th of September, just 1 week before the attack. And so what was happening was a steady drumbeat of warnings. The president, according to Condoleezza Rice, said that he was getting tired of all this, okay? He's getting tired of all these warnings, okay? What happened on August 6th, it would have been August 5th when the president's daily brief was prepared. What happened that day is that the analysts in the CIA drew up an article which they titled "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S." Okay, I'll say it one more time. Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. How do I know that? It's been in the New York Times. What else do we know about that? We know that that article talked about hijackings. We know that that article talked about al-Qaeda types taking flight training within the United States. We know that that article talked about sleeper cells of al-Qaeda that the FBI is watching in the United States. And there are certain other things we know about that. How do I know that? It's been in the Washington Post, okay? Now, that is the PDB, the President's Daily Brief item, that the administration has refused to give to the commission that's supposed to be investigating 9/11. They say, we never give the president's daily brief to anyone. Well, not so. If you look on the web, you'll see instances going back to the Johnson administration where PDBs were given in toto, sometimes sanitized, to the public media on items of great interest like this cause célèbre. So there's no justification at all for the president refusing to admit this PDB into evidence, so to speak. And the only reason that makes sense is that it would show that he was grossly negligent, grossly incompetent in not ordering measures to counter the threat that was explicated in that president's daily brief. It's part and parcel of this refusal to let Condoleezza Rice testify under oath. People are saying, Colin Powell says, well, she really wants to testify under oath. Right, give me a break. If she testifies under oath, she's either going to commit perjury or she's going to commit homicide. Homicide to the president's aspirations for a second term.
If they had heeded those warnings from the August 6th president's daily brief, what might they have done? Has there ever been a similar threat and has it ever been intercepted?
Sure. There have been several similar threats. The Millennium threat is one that's come up in the hearings here, discussed almost ad nauseum. What they should have done, obviously, if they're talking about hijacking, was to make sure that these repeated warnings were taken seriously. The FAA did not take them seriously. At very least, they could have made sure that the kinds of stringent security precautions that are taken now, as a matter of course, were introduced and introduced quickly. It's not as though the report came on August 6th. This was building up for the whole year, and they didn't know what to do. I mean, you know, that's the charitable explanation, but I think it's probably the right one. Condoleezza Rice didn't know anything about terrorism, and she didn't seem much interested. She wouldn't call a meeting. Dick Clark urgently requested her to call. She was interested in the Soviet Union. That had sort of dissipated. She was interested in Eastern Europe. She knew about those things. She didn't know about these other things. Besides, she's supposed to be the manager of all this. I have yet to see any managerial skills on the part of Condoleezza Rice. So she dropped the ball. The president went off for a month vacation to Texas. He dropped the ball. Everybody dropped the ball, and nobody alerted the people who could have prevented this, the people at the airports, the people in security, the people that Dick Clark said could have put this on the news. They had photos of a couple of these fellas that they knew were in country. So many opportunities were missed that I think that people are being unduly careful in saying, well, we can't be sure that we could have prevented 9/11. I think that if the government was working in a reasonable way, 9/11 could surely have been prevented.
If I could, I'd like to call upon your experience as an analyst of political conflicts around the world and their motivations to talk a little bit now about the geopolitical interests of the Bush administration. How do they relate, as you mentioned earlier, to the question of Israel?
Well, I think that great failing of the press here in this country is not to focus on the ideological and strategic justification for this war, which is very neatly spelled out in the documents of the Project for a New American Century, accessible to anyone who has a computer. These documents show that the strategic ideological foundation for this war come from the thought that the U.S. is the sole remaining superpower in the world, that we have an awful lot of weight to throw around, and that we would be criminally remiss were we not to throw that weight around in important areas of the world. Important areas of the world. Well, what are our major needs as a country? What's interesting is that most people forget that immediately after the George W. Bush administration took over, our country started exporting more oil than we could produce domestically. There came a realization that the world was running out of oil, which of course it is, although you won't hear that mentioned very much. Look at Exxon's most recent annual report, and you'll see a wonderful graph that shows that. So the question was, how should this administration react to that? And of course, Cheney did the the group with energy people and decided, well, we won't pursue alternative sources of energy. We'll just make sure that we secure our oil supply. So put that together with this ideological document that we need to exert our influence wherever we can and our need to do that in the Middle East where all the oil is, and you have a perfect rationale for moving against a country that could not defend itself, Iraq. This was what it was all about. The other part of it, of course, is that from a regional perspective, Israel's strategic interests and ideological interests coincide very, very nicely with those of the United States. And indeed, it's possible to say that the policymakers running our policy on Iraq have great difficulty distinguishing between the strategic interests of Israel and the strategic and the perceived strategic interests of the United States. So the object was to take over Iraq, to secure the oil supply, to make Iraq no longer any kind of threat to Israel, meager though it was before as a threat, and to secure a logistical base where we could secure that area in perpetuity. The talk was of 4 or 5 military bases in Iraq. So when people say, well, if it wasn't weapons of mass destruction, and if it wasn't ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda, well, what was it? The answer is pretty simple. It's what I just said. And other intelligence agencies were very easily arrived at that. If you look at what the Australian courageous intelligence analyst Andrew Wilkie, his testimony before the Australian Parliament said in a beautiful paragraph, look, we knew it wasn't weapons of mass destruction or ties with al-Qaeda. We reported to you very, very crisply and very succinctly what the real objectives of America were. And it wasn't rocket science. All we needed to do was to read the documents of the Project for a New American Century.
A number of political observers have said, really, oil wasn't the central thing, that oil was important, but its real importance is its role in geopolitics, namely the control of the economies of other countries of the world, not so much our own oil supply, but our control of the oil supply to other areas of the world.
Well, if you look several years ahead, you'll see that China is already a major factor, demanding more and more oil. You can look at it in various ways. You can look at it in a preemptive way, that is to seize the opportunity to prevent others from controlling the oil in Iraq, or you can look at it in the way I just described. I think it's a distinction without a difference when you come right down to it.
You had mentioned earlier that you spent a number of years studying the Soviet Union, but also China. I'm very curious, any of your current thoughts on the role of China in the world and the U.S.'s relationship to China as China becomes more and more powerful an economic force, but not necessarily a military force. What do you think is coming in the relationship of the U.S. empire to China in the next decade or so?
Well, what's very interesting is the fact that the situation that obtained just 30 years ago has been really changed completely. In those days, Henry Kissinger, to his credit, was able to play off China against Russia. He was able to secure some very tangible benefits for the United States by playing China off against Russia, including arms control agreements, including an agreement on Berlin, including a whole bunch of things by playing on the need perceived by both of those superpowers to not let the other steal a march on relations with the United States. Now the situation is very different. China and Russia, despite their age-old animosities, have a very decent working relationship. China is getting a lot of its military aircraft and other things from the Soviet Union. So the strategic equation has changed markedly, and not in the favor of the United States, because no longer is the United States able to play these two one off against the other. China is going to be a big problem down the stretch, and I'm not sure I am sure. What I am sure of is that the people who are running our foreign policy really don't have a clue with respect to how to act now so that China won't be a threat in the future.
What kind of threat might China be when you say threat? Are you talking military? Are you talking colonial? Are you talking economic? What is the threat to the United States?
Well, China already has the capability of striking us strategically. So the military threat is not to be de-emphasized. They have ICBMs, and they can use them. They have Irredenta. They have a claim on Taiwan, and that will remain until, by some miracle, that is resolved. I don't see any miracles anytime soon. In addition, China is becoming a major economic power. I think we owe an awful lot of money to China. China is also providing all of, well, not all, but most of Walmart goods. And so we're tied to China in ways that don't give us so much leverage, give China a lot of leverage. We don't, I think, have the capability of stemming the outflow of jobs from the United States because of the cheap availability of slave labor and other kinds of labor in China. So it's a very complex mix. And what bothers me is that the caliber of people that I see in our policymaking apparatus, the ones that have come with this administration, do not inspire confidence that these major challenges can be planned in a medium term, much less a long-term perspective.
One of the things that characterized the Cold War period was the constant emphasis on the threat to the United States. And in a way, that threat justified a military expansion unheard of in world history. The extent of the U.S. military presence around the world has no precedent. What is the likelihood of moving away from a conception of the world that holds that that we are always under threat to a sense of collaboration and autonomy? Given what you know about the way that the CIA works, about the way policy circles work, about that overall mindset, do you see any prospect for a revolution in thinking and a desire for coexistence over domination?
Well, what you're referring to is the key complex of decisions that happened once the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe fell apart. We talked about a peace dividend in those days, and we talked about a new world order. And that was the opportunity. That is not to say that it's lost forever. I think what you need, you talk about the CIA. Well, the CIA is not going to do anything that the president doesn't tell it to do. That's pure and simple. And, you know, what does that say? That simply says we have to elect good presidents that pick good advisors. Now, if you pick a different set of advisors, not a group that is dedicated to asserting our superiority asserting it in a most ostentatious way to say that we will never let any other country even rival us in strategic importance. If you pick a different kind of leader, I think the possibilities are immense. The world faces many problems together, environmental problems, first of all, fossil fuel problems. I think that there's lots of opportunity for forward-looking leadership, statesman-like leadership, to make a different impression on the world than the United States has been able to do in the last couple of years.
Well, I think there's a lot of cynicism out there because I think the feeling is that it is not just the person at the head of the government or the small coterie of decision makers around them, but that there's something institutional about these thrusts. I mean, the whole argument of Ralph Nader, for example, that there is not a fundamental difference between the political parties in terms of their overarching conception of U.S. power and of corporate power. I think that analysis is something that a lot of people share. And I forget who it was who said that a Democrat will still hang you, but from a lower branch. Or no, a liberal will still hang you, but from a lower branch.
Well, I hate to think that that kind of cynicism is widespread. I really have lost a lot of respect for Ralph Nader. I think that his decision to reinsert himself into this is very mischievous. I think it's mostly a function of ego.
Do you think that a change in leadership alone is going to be adequate to change the thrust? For example, let us say that John Kerry gets elected. Do you really think that we will get a fundamental change in the direction of this government?
I do. I think if you look at the folks that are running our policy, ideology, a messianic kind of attitude, it's quite remarkable. The marks that characterize the folks running our policy. These folks will be gone in early next year if the Bush administration does not win re-election. And I see immense possibilities for very concrete changes in policy. Now, some of the fundamental problems will remain. You know, the military-industrial complex will remain, but there are ways to attack those problems. And if we're not under direct threat from a Soviet Union that hasn't existed since 1991, there are immense possibilities to deal with these things. And I think forward-looking leadership without ideological blinders would have considerable latitude to institute changes.
Well, given the economic power and interest of that military-industrial complex, and my understanding is actually that in his original draft of the speech, Eisenhower used the term military-industrial congressional complex mm-hmm. and was urged to take the congressional piece of it out. But given the interests of that complex, can its control over the vast proportion of the public wealth be successfully challenged?
The answer is yes. But the corollary is it will take all of us. In other words, we can sit back and say, oh, God, it's just too hopeless. We've reached a pass where we just ought to go back in our holes. That's what they want. That's what they want. That's what they're counting on. And all too many of us are guilty of that. We are still a democracy. We still can affect things. And there's been a lot of examples of that over the last several months. If we get energized, if we get out there and act like responsible citizens, we can make an impact. We can elect good people to represent us. And if bad people get elected, we can make clear how we're feeling about these things and elect good people 2 years hence. So, yeah, sure, I think there can be change. But I think it takes all of us, not just a few.
What is the perception in policy circles in the Beltway, for example, of the protests against the war that occurred before the war and are ongoing? Is there a dialogue that can be opened? And on what grounds does that dialogue take place, particularly when the interests may be oppositional?
Well, it really depends on who's in power. What we've observed over the last 2 years is that dialogue has not been possible with this administration. No matter how immense the demonstrations, and there were millions and millions overseas, as we all know, no impact at all and no dialogue. And so that's not as it should be, of course. What does that bespeak? Well, that bespeaks the need for a different approach and a different possibility for citizens when they come out in hundreds of thousands to make some sort of impact on the body politic, to make impact on the media so that their numbers are not halved when they're reported, and for all of us to find imaginative ways to use the technology that's available to us in getting the word out that, look, this is our country. We're still going to take it back. And we'll find ways to do that. I mean, old Mother Teresa used to finish her little, I heard her once give a speech, and she said, you know, at the end of this speech, somebody's going to come to me and they're going to say, oh, Mother Teresa, you do great things. I wish I could do the things that you can do. And she said, now, I'm going to say to you now, and I just want to let you hear me here. I very sincerely wish that I could do the things that you can do. That's a profound truth.
I can't do the things that you can do. You can do things I can't do. We all operate in our own separate milieus, in our workplaces, in our churches, in our other parts of society. We got to get out there and start spreading a little truth around.
Is there anything you'd like to leave people with that we haven't covered yet?
Yes, I feel very strongly that these coming months will be the most important months in my lifetime with respect to what happens to my country. I was born in August of 1939, 6 days before Hitler sent his troops into Poland. I've lived in Germany for 5 years and had occasion to talk with all manner of Germans. I know a lot about the weeks and the months preceding the beginning of World War II. And I know how the established church and other authorities fell down in their responsibility to face up to the Hitler challenge. I know how the media were subverted and were used by Goebbels and others to further the aims of Hitler. I see so much parallelism here in this situation that it scares me greatly. And I would just say that I feel enough a dispassionate intelligence analyst to say that nothing I've seen in the last several weeks leads me to suspect that I'm overdrawing this situation. The situation is perilous, it's real, and unless the American people somehow, through some media, through some consciousness that perhaps comes of relatives and friends coming back in caskets or wheelchairs, that unless the American people get to realize the enormity, the gravity of the situation, come November, I fear for the future of our country.
Okay, well, I'd really like to thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
You're most welcome.